Hello, and welcome to Economics for Rebels, the podcast of the European Society for Ecological Economics. Up until recently, it was an act of rebellion to pursue economics as if nature mattered and the earth was finite. This rebellion must bring a major shift to economic thinking. Our podcast is dedicated to exploring the economics of just and sustainable transformations in conversations with scientists, experts, activists, pushing for rapid and radical change for people and planet.
Welcome to our podcast. I'm today's host, Sophus Tuamgesson, and you're listening to the Economics for Rebels podcast. It's now well established that contemporary society has finite ecological constraints and massive inequality in wealth, well-being, and carbon consumption. But how is the consumption of our shared ecological space distributed across society, and what's the ecological efficiency through which today's economy generates improvements in well-being? We're very happy to welcome today's guest, Dr. Marta Balciuszewicz. Marta wrote one of the most interesting ecological economics papers that I came across in the last year, empirically exploring interlinkages between energy consumption, inequality, and well-being in the UK. And we've invited her on to explore that research and its implications. Marta has the ultimate interdisciplinary background with masters in both sociology and industrial ecology. She worked for 3 years as a researcher in the Western Norway Research Institute, focusing on exploring what people in high-income countries are willing to do to reduce their carbon footprint. And next, she completed a PhD with Professor Julia Steinberger at the University of Leeds as part of the Living Well Within Limits project, focusing on household energy footprints and links to well-being in various countries around the world. Welcome, Marta.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us. So let's start big. Why should we all care about household energy consumption and their levels of welfare? What's the significance of this question for ecological economics?
Well, I think we all know that we consume too much energy. And if we want to keep ourselves within limits, within 1.5 degrees Celsius to avoid, you know, climate catastrophe, we need to reduce our energy consumption. And this is especially valid for Global North, where we overconsume energy. But how do we do that? It's a tricky question, because it's not, I cannot imagine a government just saying you have a budget of, I don't know, 50 gigajoule per person, and that's your budget for the year. I don't think that's the way to go when it comes to reductions of the energy use. So we kind of have to understand how the energy is used, by whom, and what kind of purpose it serves in terms of satisfying our needs. And when we can have that picture, we can start understanding how did we design our societies in terms of how do we satisfy our needs with energy use. And from there, we can start actually planning reductions in terms, in a way that it doesn't harm our well-being.
Okay, great. So would you mind quickly explaining to our listeners about the difference between wants and needs, and some of the differences between how neoclassical economics commonly conceptualizes of well-being versus ecological economics?
Yeah, so this is quite a complicated question, because it has these two big things. First, neoclassical versus ecological economics, and then the whole concept with needs, and then what are the differences between needs and wants. So maybe let's take it step by step. So when it comes to neoclassical understanding of well-being, it draws from mostly from preference theory, where everything is focused on maximizing pleasure. So it's based in hedonic understanding of well-being, where we not so much satisfy our needs, but wants. And in that kind of understanding, needs are not satiable. There is never enough of, you know, what we can do to satisfy our needs, or there is never enough in terms of like what we could do more to gain more of happiness or well-being. And common way to measure what is used to measure well-being in that kind of understanding in your classical economics is, for example, happiness. And we know problems with that, because you can have a population where the life expectancy is, let's say, 30, but the happiness is on the max, because people just feel happy, even though they don't have access to sanitation, they don't have enough food, they don't have, protective housing. So it's difficult to actually compare well-being of people when you use such an indicator like happiness or, you know, what people want. But it actually serves really good purpose for consumerism, because it just means that, you know, if you consume more, if we grow markets, if we grow production, then there will be only more of happy people. And that's why GDP also is used for as a proxy for living standards. But it's not, as we know as well, it's not the best indicator, and it's been criticized now for years, also in the mainstream economics. But if we then turn to a perspective of eudaimonic well-being, which is more is objective understanding of well-being, and here we come to more ecological economics understanding of well-being. In my research, actually, I drew on the analysis of Doyle and Goff, who presented the theory of human need. And here they distinguish very clearly between human needs and human wants, and also how we satisfy our needs. So first of all, they say that the well-being, our basic need, is to being able to participate in society. And this is big, because it also, you know, it includes not only our own wants, our kind of, it doesn't come from the egoistical point of view that we just live for ourselves, but takes to the account that we actually are social beings and we thrive the most in society. So to be able to participate in that society, certain needs have to be covered. And those needs include having, for example, protective housing, having enough food, having access to clean water, having basic education so we can actually be informed and being able to participate, having a secure childhood. So there's a number of universal characteristics of what means to live well and to achieve that minimal impairment in society. And these needs don't change over time, space, place. So it doesn't matter if it would be in Middle Ages or 50 years ago or 50 years from now, those needs will be the same as long we as a species don't change. And the difference is how we satisfy those needs. So, you know, we can satisfy the need for food in various ways. We can satisfy need for having protective housing by having a huge mansion or having a flat. So the way we satisfy the needs varies massively depending on culture, our individual choice, where we live, and also what kind of provisioning systems we have available to us. And by provisioning systems, I mean, for example, like social provisioning, which can involve culture and laws and regulations that we live in as a society in, and physical, like infrastructure, or, you know, if we have access to sanitation or electricity. So those factors play a significant role on how much resources and energy we actually spend on satisfying those needs.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. That's a really great explanation. So, it sounds to me like the kind of ecological economic conception here is that we have satiable needs, and therefore, you know, there is a potential finite demand that can satisfy people's needs, versus the kind of neoclassical conceptualization that we have kind of insatiable wants, and therefore potentially, you know, demand and consumption is potentially insatiable. So this relates, you know, a lot to the kind of income happiness or income well-being paradox. Yeah, what is your view on the income well-being debate?
Yeah, so if we take well-being perspective understood as objective well-being or the eudaimonic well-being. So that if we take an understanding of actually well-being and needs can be satisfied, and there are levels beyond which we can say, well, we satisfied our needs. So if we take the conceptualization of well-being as that is, that it has ingrained threshold. So there are limits to what is needed to actually achieve well-being. Right. So if we take that kind of understanding and, for example, resource use or look at income or energy use, we can actually observe saturation. So with growing energy, especially at the beginning, you can see improvements in well-being. But then at some point, it doesn't matter if we take energy or resource use or income and match it against human development indicators or well-being. We can see that at the beginning with growing income, the well-being increases, but then at certain point, it actually flattens out. So more income you have at some level, it doesn't contribute much to your well-being. And that was already shown by Julia Steinberger and Roberts in 2010 in their paper, where they showed saturation effect when they matched between human development indicators and energy use. And I could observe the same in my paper on UK on a household level. So I guess it's quite clear that we can observe saturation, and it's been proven over and over again. You know, if we take different indicators of how we understand well-being, then of course, maybe with growing income, then the happiness maybe keeps on improving. But I don't know. I think there are some studies that actually shows even with, you know, such a flaky thing like happiness, that it at some level, it also doesn't add up to the more money you have, it doesn't add up to your happiness, or it actually can decrease. But don't cite me on that. I'm not sure if I remember it correctly now.
Okay, listeners, no citing Marta on that specific fact, okay? Okay, so let's dive into this recent incredible paper of yours that I just really enjoyed. And I work a little bit on your UK households as well. So it just really hit home for me. So you evaluate relationships between UK household well-being, lifestyles, and energy consumption. Now, for starters, that's a lot of different data sets you've brought together in a very interesting way. So do you mind talking about what data you used and why, and how you processed it all to link these things together?
Yeah, so I used various data sets. So first of all, UK has amazing statistical bureau with amazing number of data sets, which is just Eldorado for researchers. And I found one particularly interesting study, which is called Understanding Society Survey. And it's a longitudinal study. It started in 1991. And it's conducted by Essex University. And I took panel number 10 from them, which includes years between 2018 and 2020. But mostly, I think it was conducted in 2019. And in that survey, you can find myriad of information regarding culture, health, income, flying habits, and also like history of multi-generational history. So if someone just moved to the country or been for a longer time, and some expenditures, but not much. And that was a weakness of that survey, because to calculate energy footprints of households in Understanding Society Survey, I needed to know all of the expenditures of the households, because this is the way how we calculate, you know, how much energy per pound spent on food, for example, there is. So that was a problem. But at the same time, there is another survey, which is called the Living Cost and Food Survey, which actually has all of the expenditures and they're all national representative. So this survey, okay, so how it works. This survey consists of all types of expenditures that that households can have. And that involves sending diaries to households, which they have for around 2 weeks, and they just fill in what kind of expenditures they had. And that is then used to calculate consumption in UK by different types of households. So you can use that kind of survey with big economic tables that are used to build input-output tables, and with extra data from energy, so from International Energy Agency, to build a model, like input-output model, to calculate so-called conversion factors. So how much megajoule per pound spent, or, I don't know, clothing, for example, there is. So I use that to calculate conversion factors, to then apply them for households in Understanding Society survey. But of course, I didn't have for every household, I didn't have all type of expenditures. So I use additional information like amount of number of flights that households had in a given year, or how many kilometers they drove with different cars, because I also had access to types of cars that people use. And I had some expenditures on electricity and food and restaurants. So with some additional statistical analysis and with matching Living Cost and Food Survey with Understanding Society Survey in statistical way, I could either estimate some of the footprints depending on common characteristics in both surveys, or just by using additional information like physical quantities, I could calculate physical conversion factors for given type of product or service that households used. So it sounds a little bit more, it sounds maybe a little bit complicated, but overall, it was a kind of novel way of using two surveys and estimating footprints. And of course, it has its weaknesses, because when you use one survey to estimate other type of households in another survey, you know, you can argue that maybe it's not the best way, or it's not accurate enough. But for the biggest categories where we actually observe biggest footprints, like flying, driving, or housing, energy, I actually got information from the households from Understanding Society survey. So, but I guess a lot of people could discuss the methods, and I really would like to hear from people then what they think about it, because this method can be developed further.
I think it was an amazing amount of work that went into this analysis. It was so impressive. So what were the key empirical results of your analysis?
Yeah, I want to focus maybe mostly on talking a little bit about what my results shows in terms of inequality, and then also in terms of how energy is linked to well-being. So first of all, in terms of inequalities, it was not maybe so new, because we already know from reports like Oxfam that there are massive inequalities and the richest are using the most carbon footprint. And this was also they have the biggest emissions. And this was also proven in my paper with energy use. But at the same time, it's always shocking to see those numbers, you know, to kind of produce results and just see yet again that bottom half of energy users are actually responsible for just 1/5 of the total energy use, while the top 10% use, you know, 18 times more than the bottom 10% of energy users. And at the same time, if you look at the energy use by income, we can see that just on when it comes to flying, people spend in the top 10% of UK earners use around 103 gigajoule of energy just on flying, which includes domestic and international flights. And this 103 gigajoule is a total energy footprint of the bottom 20% of income earners. And that includes, you know, the total. So it's everything from eating food, from flying, to driving your car, buying clothes. And that's a massive inequality in the distribution of energy use, but also how this energy is used. Another key results in this paper were that were linked to matching energy use with well-being. And here maybe I should just explain shortly how I defined high and low well-being. I created a binary variable which categorized households in between having high or having low well-being. And having high well-being included characteristics linked to mental and physical health, financial situation, subjective well-being, assessment of poverty, so being above poverty line, having adequate heating, and also loneliness. So there was a mix of material and non-material kind of indicators that I used for operationalizing well-being and then creating that kind of indicator. And what I've seen in my results was that only a small share of population, which would be around 3%, achieve well-being or high well-being on a very low level of energy use, which is 50 gigajoule per adult equivalent. And at the same time, those with high well-being, within the top 10% of energy users, their energy use could vary from 400 to 800 gigajoule per adult equivalent. So it's a massive variation. With additional statistical analysis, I saw that actually well-being and energy use were not that well correlated. But for example, physical health and income was correlated with air transport. But at the same time, when it comes to flying, it was not correlating to well-being overall. So flying is not correlating to mental or mental health or loneliness or other non-material indicators. Yeah, so when I also looked in between differences between those who have low well-being and a high well-being, I also saw that car transport plays a significant role in need satisfaction. So in UK, it seems like car is a very important need satisfier, and with higher car usage, the well-being also increases. So it might not be a very positive thing because it might imply lock-ins, but this is how currently the infrastructure and kind of provisioning for human need is constructed in UK. I also looked into more specifically into characteristics of people with high and low well-being in terms of their socioeconomic characteristics. And there were some, it was quite disheartening actually to see that those with low well-being are disproportionately female, single, without work, and dedicate 2 hours more than the high energy users on unpaid housework. So when I checked the group with, you know, low well-being and also low energy use, this kind of picture emerged. And also I saw that gender, ethnicity, and age impact negatively the probability of having high well-being. And at the same time, those with low well-being are also disproportionately represented by rentees. And that means that if you rent, you cannot decide about, renovating your house, insulating your walls. So if you live in poorly insulated house, which in UK is a case for many people, you actually have to spend more energy to heat it up. And if you're on low income, as also a lot of people in that group with low well-being are, then you very quickly stand before choice heat or eat, for example. So there's a lot of dimensions to that kind of energy poverty that also emerged in the results. And when I looked on the other end of spectrum, so for those who use a lot energy and also have high well-being, I saw that within the top 10% of energy users, this group is on average middle-aged, white, male, and they also work long hours and having two cars, but surprisingly no children. And this cluster also usually earns the most. So it contains the highest 25% of income earners in the UK. And they also tend to live more on outside of the city or in rural areas. So where public transport might be not available or reliable, or maybe if it is, they choose still to drive more. And one of the things that we also observe is that car transport increases almost 20-fold from the lowest 10% to the top 1% of energy users with high well-being.
Okay, brilliant. Thanks so much for explaining that. So my interpretation of the kind of big picture takeaway is that we've generated a hugely ecologically inefficient system where there's huge inequality in carbon consumption, but this is very disproportionately weighted towards income levels and activities that deliver relatively little increase in well-being. Is that kind of a fair summary?
Yes, I think it's a fair summary. And especially, you know, taking flights, for example, I don't know if many people know that 70% of flights taken in UK are by just 15% of the population. So we have all of this infrastructure, you know, railway, roads, and not to mention airports itself, just to serve 15% of population that flies. And as we saw from, or as I already mentioned, flights do not contribute to our well-being. So yeah, it's how we designed our provisioning for need satisfaction and what kind of needs or wants in this case it covers is it's not necessarily serves the actual needs that should be covered. And the other thing is also the car dependence, where we designed our cities towards use of car, and we kind of escalate that need with the way how we choose to live, and where are the shops, where are the schools, where is work, to the level that without car we almost cannot achieve well-being or cannot satisfy our basic needs.
Yeah, so what do you think are the main policy implications for your work? And we can cover both the kind of the idealistic ecological economic policies and those that are more politically feasible there.
So I think, you know, even though I said that only small percent of population have high well-being with low energy use, at the same time, we can see that I think around a half of energy users actually, they use less than the average, national average energy and still have high well-being. So this is quite... I guess, a hopeful message. And at the same time, those with high well-being and high energy use, they are in minority. So it means that we can reconcile maintenance of high well-being and energy demand reduction. So, you know, it is possible to get to the level that is necessary to keep us within 1.5 degrees. The other question is, 100 gigajoules, for example, enough of a reduction, or should we be more on the level of, for example, 50 gigajoules? And that 50 gigajoules, what does it imply? Well, in terms of UK, it implies not flying, using less car, and also having more energy efficient housing. But some of the reduction of energy can be really easily achieved. So let's take flights, for example. We know that it doesn't contribute to our well-being. So it would be easy to tax flying and actually push for policies that reduce number of flights, that reduce, you know, the need for going for weekend shopping in Paris or something like that. So I think it's all possible and easily achievable if there are if there is a push for it, I guess, and political will. Another thing with stringent taxation on high emitters, we could also think about different products like SUVs, for example, that just flooded the car market in the recent years. We could also ban those kind of cars because they do not contribute anything to improvement of how we satisfy, you know, need of or how we drive or how we get to work. I don't think SUVs are necessary for that. So it's not necessarily that we will live less well, or that we will have to go back to caves, as Joe Millard Hopkins mentioned in his paper. So I think it's, for the policy analysis, I think it's a helpful message of having more ammunition for reduction of unnecessary and excess energy use, like within the car consumption and or car driving and flights. And at the same time, it also points to vulnerable groups that should be prioritized in energy transition if we want to have a just energy transition. So policy makers should be also very careful on how they address different policies aiming on reduction of energy, because if we touch on people that depend on car, for example, for the need satisfaction, and we try to tax that, it might be problematic. So this kind of study can show which groups are dependent on different energy use for their need satisfaction. And from that, we could then design policies that actually take into account how energy is used.
Yeah, brilliant. This has been such a good summary. And yeah, I can't thank you enough, Marta. So to close out this episode, I'm going to ask the question that Sandra and I ask all our guests. You know, what is your rebellion?
Well, yeah, I was thinking about this question. What do I rebel? And I think I rebel mostly against the notion that we need growth and increased consumption to live well. And it is so amazing to have a paper like that where I can show with the data that this is not necessarily needed. And something that we, I think, already know intuitively, to be able to prove it with data, it's, as an academic, it feels just very rebellious. So yeah, that's my current rebellion, to just spread the word about what I found, and hopefully there will be more research like that as well.
Yeah, brilliant. So many thanks to Marta, and thanks to all of you for spending time with us.
Thank you for listening to the podcast series of the European Society for Ecological Economics. If you like the conversation and your work is related to ecological economics in any discipline, consider becoming a member of our society to stay connected. If you are ready to discuss the topic, join our Facebook group called European Society for Ecological Economics.